Srila Prabhupada ki, Sri Bhakti Vedam Chiki, Dharajna Bhagavatam ki, Dharaj Maharaj ki, Nitai Goprin Maharaj ki. So I'd like to welcome back some of the old students who have not been back for
a few gantos.
Good to have you back.
Good to see you. Welcome. Good.
So, I'll give you the key memory verses for this section. The K and B's, the verses you need to memorize for the exams for this section.
So, Canto 10, Chapter 1, Text Number 4. Canto 10, Chapter 2. Text number 19. Canto 10, chapter 2, text number 30. And Canto 10, chapter 2, text number 32. So 10.1.4, 10.2.19, 10.2.13, 10.2.32.
So you can write them down. Also, you put them on the... How do you do it?
Send a message.
Then you send the open book topics as well.
I will.
Open book topics are here. If you need the open book topics for this section, they're here. Or else they'll be on, you'll get an email as well.
Okay, so what did we discuss last week?
What has happened so far in the first chapter of the 10th canto? What has taken place so far?
Maharaj Parikshit is asking all the questions relating to the appearance of Lord Krishna. And now Maharaj Parikshit and Sri Goswami both are eager to go with the process of Lord Krishna. And he's also mentioned how Maharaj Parikshit, because of hunger and thirst, offended Sami Krishi. He has now, for 7 days now, he's lost the taste for hunger and thirst. He's completely absorbed in giving over the past time.
Good. Anything else? So we're hearing in the beginning that one has to develop Vasudev Kata, Ruchi, or taste for hearing. This is imperative. If you want to perfect your human form of life, you have to have a taste for hearing about Vasudev Kata, which means topics about Krishna. And the 10th canto is simply topics about Krishna. So if you don't have a taste for hearing this, you cannot transcend the material energy. You can't go back home, back to Godhead. Secondly, that... No noise. In the class, no noise. Otherwise, you have to stay outside. Okay, Madhav? Okay. So... Then we heard the description how Mother Bhumi approached Loprama. Loprama then went to the
demigods and
took the demigods with him to Shwetadrupa, which is the ocean of milk. When they arrived at Shwetadrupa, at the ocean of milk, they began to pray. Loprama offered prayers, and he received instruction from within his heart that Krishna would soon come to earth, and the demigods needed to enter into the Yadu dynasty. So that's where we've ended up. Now tonight we're going to go from verses 27 to 41, and we're hearing about Krishna's parents, whose names are
Vasudeva
and Devaki.
Okay. So we're hearing about the past time.
So this is leading into the appearance of Krishna. Krishna will soon appear in Mathura and Vrindavan simultaneously. Yes.
Okay.
So text number 27.
Formerly, Shurasen, the chief of the Yadu dynasty, had gone to live in the city of Mathura, where he enjoyed the places known as Mathura and Shurasen. Since that time, the city of Mathura have been the capital of all the kings of the Yadu dynasty. The city and district of Mathura are very intimately connected with Krishna, for Lord Krishna lives there eternally.
It is understood that Mathura city is the transcendental abode of the Lord Krishna. It is not an ordinary material city, for it is eternally connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vrindavan is within the jurisdiction of Mathura and still continues to exist, but Mathura and Vrindavan are intimately connected with Krishna eternally. It is said that Lord Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. Vrindavanam parityaja padam ekam na gacchati. At present, the place known as Vrindavan in the district of Mathura continues in its position as a transcendental place, and certainly anyone who goes there becomes transcendentally purified. Navadvip Dham is also intimately connected with Vrajbhumi. Narottam Das Thakur says, "She called the Mandal of Bhumi, Devi Jani Chintamani, Tara Aye, Vrajbhumi Vas." Vrajbhumi refers to Mathura Vrindavan, and Gaura Mandal Bhumi includes Navadvip. These two places are not different. Therefore, anyone living in Navadvip Dham, knowing Krishna and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to be same personality, lives in Vrajbhumi, Mathura Vrindavan. The Lord has made it convenient for the conditioned souls to live in Mathura, Vrindavan, and Navadvip, and thus be directly connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Simply by living in these places, one can immediately come in contact with the Lord. There are many devotees who vow never to leave Vrindavan and Mathura. This is undoubtedly a good vow, but if one leaves Vrindavan and Mathura, or Navadvip Dham, for the service of the Lord, he is not disconnected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At any rate, we must understand the transcendental importance of Mathura Vrindavan and Navadvip Dham. Anyone who executes devotion service in this place certainly goes back home, back to Godhead, after giving up his body. Thus the words Mathura Bhagavan Yatra Nityam Sanihito Hari are particularly important. A devotee should fully utilize these instructions to the best of his ability. When the Supreme Lord personally appears, he appears in Mathura because of his intimate connection with this place. Therefore, although Mathura and Vrindavan are situated on the same planet Earth, they are transcendental abodes of the Lord.
Very good. What are the points
in the first paragraph?
The importance of the Dhams not explained. How even if a person don't live there physically, if he's carrying out Lord's devotional service, then he's equally living in the Dham.
Nice point. That's good. What else is there? Good. What else? Okay. So hands up if you've been to Vrindavan. Okay. Hands up if you've been to Navadvip Mayapur. Okay. Good. What about Jagannath Puri? Okay, good. You've been to most of the dance. That's good. So, it is being explained here that the Dharma is eternal. So, in Brihat Bhagavatamrita is like a natural commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, it describes that Gopal Kumar, he travels from both places. He goes from what we call Gokul Vrindavan. Gokul Vrindavan generally means the Vrindavan in this world, Boma Vrindavan. And then we have Goloka. So generally we say that is Goloka, the spiritual world. And we say when it comes to this material world, when the Dharma enters the material world, then it's called Gokul. But it is explained that when Gopal Kumar was traveling between the two, he saw that there was no difference. He says practically no difference. Maybe a few small differences. The acharyas point out three differences that we can note. One is there's no Jamma Lila. No child of Krishna is always Kaishor. He's always in that age. He's always eternally 15, 16 like that in the Goloka Dham. But when he comes here, he does the Kaumara Lila. So he's like under 5 years old. And then he goes through Paukanda. So it appears that he is growing like that. So that's one difference between the two dhams. The other, one other difference is there are no asuras in Goloka. There's only a rumor. Like called Abhiman means, like a mental conception. They say, Keshi is coming, or Arishta is coming, like this. Everyone's like that, but they're not there. It just aids the passing. But in Balma Vrindavan, they physically manifest to give it a semblance of human-like pastime. Otherwise, everyone would become confused. If there's no demon there, then everyone would think, well, why is it that everyone's acting like this? So they have to manifest. And then the final difference, which is mentioned, is the gopis, they have husbands. In the spiritual world, the husbands don't manifest. Like Radharani's so-called husband is called? Abhiman means like a mental concept. So he's not actually there in Goloka. The husbands don't actually exist. But there is like a semblance that there are husbands in the spiritual world. They will say like that. They are married to this person, or they are married to that person. Because then the parakī above, or the relationship between Krishna and the gopis, they can have the feeling of being unmarried. If there's no husbands there, it makes it difficult. So there's like a conception of the husbands. The husbands are not physically manifest. But when they come to Gokul, to this place, then the husbands manifest. So you'll see the husbands. So there's some difference. And otherwise, the basic premise is that Goloka and Gokul are non-different. It is spiritual energy. So when it comes to this world, when the Dham descends to this world, then Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in Navadvipa Dham Mahatmya that there's a thin covering of Maya, which covers the Dham, and we see that. So one time one of the devotees said, Prabhupada, there are pigs here, and there's sewage, and there's Vrindavan. You go to Vrindavan these days, materially speaking, in many ways it's quite unpleasant, materially speaking. But then Prabhupada said, you are not seeing the Dham. You just see pigs and garbage, and you see, like that. I mean, there's material difficulties there now. Actually, Srila Prabhupada said, he created all these other Dhams around the world. Hema, is that your? Okay. If it stops, it's okay. But if it keeps going, then yeah, just go. So then Prabhupada said that the new Dhams that he created, like New Govinda, New Nandagram, New Varshana, New Vrindavan, all these places, he said they're actually better than the Dhams in this world. Because the Dhams in this world are very contaminated. Whereas if you go to like New Nandagram or New Govinda, it's very peaceful. So it's easier to practice without distraction. These days when you go to Vrindavan, sometimes it's hard to concentrate. There's loudspeakers everywhere. Sachinandan Swami says the loudspeakers are the enemy of the sadhaka. Now you're trying to chant your japa and there's some like Hindi bhajan coming out. They're being played 10 times louder than it needs to. So it's very difficult sometimes to concentrate. But the basic premise is the two dhams are not different. We get caught up on the material level, but if you can enter the actual dham, both are identical. So Prabhupada says, we have to become attached to the holy dham. Otherwise you'll be attached to your home in this world. Are you attached to your home in this world? Your place where you were born, are you attached to that place? Then Bhagavatam says you are muta. You're no better than a cow or an ass. Because you're attached to something mundane in this world. So how do we overcome our attachments in this world? Krishna's basic teaching in the Bhagavad Gita is paramjishwani bhattatish. You can only give up a lower thing when you have a higher thing. So how do you give up your attachment to your home in this world? You have to become attached to Vrindavan Dham and Mayapur Dham and Jagannath Puri. And then you give up your attachment automatically. So the reason we're attached to anything in this world is because we're not attached to the spiritual. So Prabhupada says, in Nectar of Devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami, he lists the most important items of bhakti. And when it comes to Mathura Vas, to residing in the Dham, then Prabhupada said, you have to become attached to the holy Dham, like it's your home. So Prabhupada always says, go back home, back to Godhead. He said in this purport. We need to go back home. So home is where our attachment should lie. So we should become attached to Vrindavan. We should become attached to Mayapur and Jagannath Puri. Now how do you become attached to them? Yeah, you have to spend time there. You have to spend time there. What's that?
And hear about the Dhams.
Hear about them, but we have to spend time in the Dhams. Srila Prabhupada instructed everyone in ISKCON, we don't follow all of Prabhupada's instructions, but he instructed everyone in ISKCON, you should go to the Holy Dham once a year. He gave that instruction. And even in 1974, or something around about that time, there were 300 devotees coming from America. And I think it was just America. 300 devotees coming from America to the Mayapur Festival. And there wasn't much facility back then. And the prasadam was not very good. The devotees got sick. You know, it was like, it was some austerity at that time. Well, not like now, you go there and there's restaurants and all these things. It was austere. Not, you know, now you have your, what do you have for breakfast over there in Mayapur?
Pizza.
Everyone has pizza for breakfast. This is not normal. Everyone has pizza for breakfast. So there was no facility back then. It was very austere. But the devotees would come. 300 devotees would fly from America to Mayapur for the festival. And Rameshwar Prabhu, he was the in charge of the BBT in North America. So devotees were collecting. So 300 devotees going across was $300,000. Because everyone's airfare is $1,000 and then you have to go across. So, and he said to Prabhupada, he said, why don't we not send all the devotees for 1 year and then we'll save $300,000 that we can put back into the BBT, we can print more books. And Prabhupada said, no. He said, everyone should go. So that's how much emphasis Prabhupada put on going to the Holy Dham. And still devotees don't do it. Prabhupada, he came to America in 65. 66 is when ISKCON really began to get going, 66. And then 68, right, like late 67, then Prabhupada has to go back to India because he has problems, health problems. So he goes back to India and then he comes back the second time, early 68, and that's when ISKCON really begins to grow. And then up until 1970, he's in the West, but then from 70 to 74, he spends at least 9 months a year in India. And a lot of what Prabhupada was doing in India was developing Mayapur and Vrindavan and Juhu. That was mainly what he was doing. And that was how much emphasis he placed. And devotees, we still don't appreciate enough how much emphasis Prabhupada placed. That's why we're trying to build the big temple there. The reason the temple's not being build as quickly as it should, because devotees are not giving enough money for it. Because devotees don't appreciate how much effort Prabhupada put into these things, and how much Prabhupada wanted these things to happen. So you have to become attached to the Dham. How do you become attached? You have to spend time in the Holy Dham. It was Prabhupada's instructions. And devotees think, I don't know why these days, but devotees think, oh, I'll go every 10 years, or I'll go every 20 years, or, you know, a devotee came with me last year, he hadn't been for 35 years to Mayapur. So Prabhupada gave us this instruction, so we should try to fill it. Even if you can't go every year, but you should try to go regularly, at least the desire should come. Because by being in the Dham, you develop attachment to the Holy Dham. And we have to, if you want to leave your attachment from this world, I personally found in my own spiritual life, one of the most effective ways to overcome your attachments in this world is to replace them with attachment to Vrindavan and Mayapur. So we have to become attached. So you have to spend as much time as you can. Why don't you just leave everything and just go and live there for the rest of your life? You don't need to come back to Australia. Just go and live there. Just spend the rest of your life in Mayapur. Okay. Most of us are not ready to do that. We don't have the adhika. But at least we should visit regularly. So Prabhupada is emphasizing here the importance of living in the Holy Dham. It's called Mathura Vas. Vas means staying in a place. Right? Doesn't mean just going for a few days, but go for a long period of time, an extended period of time. Spend time in these places. Now, why are the holy dharmas special? What is special about Vrindavan? What is special about Mathura? Yeah, pure devotees have lived there, they're purified by the place. What else? Lord's pastimes. What? The Lord performed the pastimes. What is more accurate? What is the more accurate description? Then the Lord performed the pastimes there. These are returned. Nitya Lila. Krishna's there right now in Vrindavan. You can be in Vrindavan, right? But are you aware that Krishna is there right now? The pastimes are eternal. Krishna is there right now in Vrindavan. It's called Prakat and Aprakat Lila. Aprakat means unmanifest. You can't see, but he is there. Prakat means you can see. Hands up if you can see Krishna. No? When you go to Vrindavan, why can't we see Krishna? Because we have no desire to see Krishna. Prabhupada went on Braj Mandal Parikram, 1931 or 32, I think. And he went around with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And Prabhupada said, I was expecting that Krishna would come out from behind a tree at any moment. So that's what we should, that's the kind of attitude we need to develop. What do you think of when you go to Vrindavan? Are you meditating that Krishna may step out from behind a tree at any moment? Or are you thinking, I hope they don't run out of pizza tonight at the end of the day? So what are you thinking? It's up to you. If you want to see Krishna, you can see Krishna now. Prabhupada says it takes one moment to see Krishna. But when is that moment? When you're in Vrindavan, you're hoping that you will see Krishna at any moment. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan prayed, Hey Radhe, Brajadevi ki chalalite, Hey Nanda Sunu, Kuta, Kuta means Kuta. Where are you? Where are you now? Are you on the side of Govanand Hill? Are you on the bank of the Jamuna? Where are you now? And Prabhupada would often quote this and say they were calling out, Where are you? Where are you? So that is the mood that we should develop. That's how you advance in Krishna consciousness. So the dharms are where Krishna eternally performs his pastimes. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is there. Today is Advaita Acharya's appearance day. So, what do you meditate on a day like this? You meditate on Advaita Bhavan, or Shantipur, or the places where he's performed his pastimes, or in Vrindavan, just near near the Madan Mohan temple, is where Advaita Acharya sat on the bank of the Jamuna and worshipped the Shalagram Shila, and called out for Lord Chaitanya to please descend into this world. So all these things you can meditate on today. But if you haven't been to these places, how will you meditate on these things? So deepen your experience by going to the holy dharma. Just like if you tell me about your home, you say, yeah, my home is like this in India. My home is like this, it's like this. But until I go there, I really don't know what it's like. I hear about it, but I don't really appreciate it. But when you go to Vrindavan, then you appreciate, oh, this is what it's like. This is where Krishna did the Rasa Lila. This is where Krishna fought with Keshi. This is where Krishna jumped off the Kadamba tree to chastise Kaliya. So you can meditate on all these places. And then Krishna consciousness becomes very powerful. So, Prabhupada said, anyone who resides there, they become purified. So even if you just go there for a few hours, you become purified. What to speak if you spend 3 days? I've seen non-devotees, or I've seen people who are not practicing carefully Krishna consciousness. I've seen their consciousness very much changed by going to the holy dharmas. My mother, I took her to the holy dharma, and she was deeply influenced. The last day she was there, she chanted 64 rounds. In Australia, she chants like one round sometimes. But there she could chant, and it was affecting her. And the day she got to Vrindavan, the next day, she told me, she said, I want to leave. Because she'd just been to Mayapur and Puri. Mayapur is very soft. Puri is very nectarian. And then she went to Vrindavan. The day she got there, she said, I want to leave this place. It's too intense. And I said, well, we're here for another 10 days. So. I said, if you want to go and see the Taj Mahal, she's down there. Otherwise. And she stayed. And she got pure and she said, this place is very powerful. So that is the potency of the holy Dharma. Even someone who does not have devotion, they can get purified very quickly. And then Prabhupada says that the two dharmas are identical. Navadvipa and Vrindavan are identical. So we have to develop this consciousness that the two of them are identical. There's deep pastimes describing the twin identity of the two dharmas. And finally, Prabhupada points out that in order to become purified, we have to learn to live in the dharma in the mind. Rupa Goswami says, if you cannot live in Vrindavan, you have to live there in your mind. So every day, when you chant your japa every day, where are you? What do you meditate on while you chant your japa? Do you meditate on Albert Park? Do you meditate on your office? That's sad. What do you meditate on? So we should be in the holy Dharma while we're chanting everywhere else. We should be in the holy Dharma. My spiritual master told me this. I'd been a devotee for 1 or 2 years. I was just a new devotee, but he told me it. He said, when you chant, you should meditate on the holy Dharma. He gave me the instruction a long time ago. So when you chant, you should be in the holy Dharma. You should visualize, you should meditate, you should be there. As much as you can. So we have to go to the holy Dharma. So here, it's describing that the Yadus, their capital has been Mathura for many years. Why is their capital Mathura? Because it's a holy place. They want to remember Krishna. That's it. If you get service in Mayapur Vrindavan, it's very fortunate. But you have to have qualification to stay there. And you have to have Krishna's permission. No permission, no admission. They say that in Vrindavan. The Brijbasis say that. No permission, no admission. I know that myself. I go to Vrindavan. Sometimes I've thought over the years I'll stay in Vrindavan on my own and teach at the MIHE or the BIHE. You know, devotees offer me service, but no permission, no admission. I can't stay there. Because my body does strange things and Krishna's saying, come on, get back. Right, go back. Go back to the other place. That's where you should be serving. So if you don't get permission, you can't stay there. But if we do get permission, it's very advantageous to serve in the holy Dharma. Any points?
Yeah, one question.
Yes, Mataji.
Where is Himardesh?
For what?
Where is Himardesh? Is there any place where
he's not there? Krishna is my Lord,
he's everywhere. He's everywhere. I don't understand the question. I know there's a deep philosophical point behind it. I have no idea what it is about.
Well, according to the second verse of the Chatur Smriti,
he's everywhere.
Yeah, he's, nothing is separate from him.
Yeah, so we know that.
So why can't you see him every day?
You can see, because we just said
it. Why can't you see everybody?
We didn't say that you could not. Well, then see it like that. Nothing's stopping you from seeing it like that, so see it like that.
You can see the Lord in your house.
Yeah, well, that's what we just said. Prabhupada said if you're living in the West, then they're there in your mind. We just said that. Okay? Any other point?
Just a question. It sounds very strong to send you out to basically. Are asking not to actually go and reside in Vrindavan. What do we do in that situation?
We follow your guru.
Here we are trying to sort of build an attention at the same time.
Yeah, so go once a year. That's the instruction of Prabhupada gave us. Just follow whatever your guru says. My guru said I have to go over here. He gave me that instruction. So I try to do that. I try to follow that instruction. So that was Prabhupada's instruction. Prabhupada's the founder of Charivishnu. He said we should all go over here, so we should do it. What's the issue? What's the problem?
staying there full time, that's a different thing. But you have to get permission from your spiritual master. You have to get permission from your spiritual master for any major thing you do in your life. If you think you're going there, then you have to get permission. And half the devotees go there, come back anyway. So, you know, devotees pack up everything, they sell everything, they go there, and they come back 6 months later, and they say it was too difficult. So you have to consult with your guru before you do. You think you're going on?
No, I'm just asking.
Yeah, you have to consult. I mean, if you consult with your guru, then it's life is not so difficult as long as you're always consulting. If you don't consult, life becomes difficult. If you do consult. Any other points?
Can you elaborate on that point when you're saying that in spiritual world there is no demons and talismans at all? Very necessary.
I already explained. It's literal. They're not there. It's just their mental conception. I already explained it. Any other point?
I also like that there is no better stealing pastimes in Golok Vrindavan. The better stealing pastime is only in Bonny Vrindavan. Is that true?
Because of Krishna's age? Yeah, it would be like that.
Yeah. In fact, I have heard that actually Bonny Vrindavan pastimes are much more relishable in a way because all these pastimes are absent in the spiritual world.
Yeah, Vishnuchakravarti Thakur says that when diamonds are on a black background, they become more. So in the material world, when Krishna has his pastimes here, they become more like effulgent. So yeah, there's some things which you don't see in Goloka because they can't be performed in Goloka. So there's something, in some ways it is said to be true, that there's some things in material pastimes that are more relishable. Any other point?
Some time ago, Vasudev, who belonged to the demigod family or the Shura dynasty, married Devaki. After the marriage, he mounted his chariot to return home with his newly married wife. Kamsa, the son of King Ugrasen, in order to please his sister Devaki on the occasion of her marriage, took charge of the reins of the horses and became the chariot driver. He was surrounded by hundreds of golden chariots. Devaki's father, King Devaka, was very much affectionate to his daughter. Therefore, while she and her husband were leaving home, he gave her a dowry of 400 elephants nicely decorated with golden garlands. He also gave 10,000 horses, 1,800 chariots, and 200 very beautiful young maid servants, fully decorated with ornaments. Rohini, you want to read it?
The system of giving a dowry to one's daughter has existed in Vedic civilization for a very long time. Even today, following the same system, a father who has money will give his daughter an opulent dowry. A daughter would never inherit the property of her father, and therefore an affectionate father, during the marriage of his daughter, would give her as much as possible. A dowry, therefore, is never illegal according to the Vedic system. Here, of course, the gift offered as a dowry by Devaka to Devaki was not ordinary. Because Devaka was a king, he gave a dowry quite suitable to his royal position. Even an ordinary man, especially a high-class brahmana, kshatriya, or vaishya, is supposed to give his daughter a liberal dowry. Immediately after the marriage, the daughter goes to her husband's house, and it is also a custom for the brother of the bride to accompany his sister and brother-in-law to exhibit affection for her. This system was followed by Kamsa. These are all old customs in the society of Varnashram Dharma, which is now wrongly designated as Hindu. These long-standing customs are nicely described here.
Any points?
That
time they were, the dowry was used with affection. But now they are forced to be. The good days
have gone. Yeah.
The good days have gone.
Yeah.
Any other point? So this is the Vedic system, Vedic culture. It's very intelligent culture. There's a reason why all these things happen. These days, it is the general custom is when the parents pass away, then the property is inherited. But in many ways, it's much more logical that the property is inherited earlier on, because then someone can establish their life. So the daughter, upon getting married, she was given wealth at that time, so she can establish herself. And then the father knows she's safe, she has everything she needs, like that. So it's a better system in many ways. And then the son, he would inherit everything later in life. When the father is old, not when he's passed away, but when he's older, then he says, okay, now you run everything, you have everything, manage all the properties, like that. The father's still in control, but it's like there's a retirement there. So it's a much more healthy system. Whereas these days, it doesn't necessarily take place like that. So this is the Vedic system. The basic point that we need to draw from this is we have to look after our children. It's our responsibility to give them what they need, materially and spiritually. That's what it means to be a parent. It says in the Bhagavatam, do not become a mother or a father unless you can deliver them back to Godhead. Obviously, that's the most important thing, but we also have material responsibility. We have to give them everything they need materially as well, according to our capacity. Everything's very complicated these days, Kali Yuga, because the children aren't necessarily what you want them to be, and it's all a little confusing. But in the old days, in the Bhagavatam, life was a lot more simple in many ways. So they gave a great deal of wealth. No? How many elephants? That's a lot of wealth. Those elephants. So what would take place then, if you were given wealth at the time of your marriage, then later on if you didn't have money, then you could sell or trade those things that you had. So, you give an elephant. An elephant's worth an incredible amount of money back then. These days people don't really want an elephant. But back then it was a great commodity to have an elephant. It was a huge commodity. So to have an elephant, it's like, and that was a great deal of wealth. At your discretion, and horses also. These days people don't want horses. Previously, to have horses, it was a great, and chariots and all these things. So this was a great deal of wealth which was given. So that's the basic system. The basic system is we should look after our children, materially and spiritually, and give as many horses and elephants when your children get married. These days, different. Maybe you give a car or something like that. Sometimes in the Greek families around Melbourne, when the kids get married, they give them a house on the day of their marriage. Yeah, because the Jewish people live just over here. The day you get married, that's it. It's all set up. The main point is there's loyalty to the family. So like you get everything and then you just walk off. No, you're very connected to that family. There's a great deal of responsibility to that family. That's how the Vedic culture was too. You would get all these things, but you were very surrendered to your family, very connected.
So it's illegal now, isn't it? Because there are too many crimes being committed because of the dowry system. A lot of people, if they are poor, the parents are poor, and then they can't give their daughter a dowry, then they are creating a lot of crimes, so it becomes illegal. You cannot get the dowry from there.
Yeah, you can't demand it. But even back then, they didn't demand it, it was just given freely. Devika, he wanted to give it. It wasn't like, Surasane was saying, well, if you don't give a dowry, there's not going to be a marriage. But he wanted to give it, so that was the system. It was a culture society. Everyone looked after each other. Everyone was happy. Any points? O beloved son, Maharaj Pariksit, when the bride and bridegroom were ready to start, conch shells, bugles, drums and kettle drums all vibrated in concert for their auspicious departure. While Kamsa, controlling the reins of the horses, was driving the chariot along the way, an unembodied voice addressed him, "You foolish rascal, the eighth child of the woman you are carrying will kill you." Priya Vanapuru.
the old spoke of the son of Dharmata, referring to the 8th pregnancy, but did not really say whether the child was to be born, was to be a son or a daughter. Even if Kamsa were to see that the 8th child of Devaki was a daughter, he should have no doubt that the 8th child was to kill him. According to the Vishwakosha dictionary, the word Dharva means embryo, and also Abhaka or child. Kamsa was affectionate towards his sister, and therefore he had become the chariot driver to carry her and his brother-in-law to their home. The demigods, however, did not want Kamsa to be affectionate towards Devaki, and therefore, from an unseen position, they encouraged Kamsa to offend her. Moreover, the 6 sons of Marichi had been cursed to take birth from the womb of Devaki. And upon being killed by Kamsa, they would be delivered. When Devaki understood that Kamsa would be killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who would appear from her womb, she felt great joy. The word Bahas is also significant because it indicates that the ominous vibration condemned Kamsa for acting just like a beast of burden by carrying his enemy's mother.
Okay, so any points?
Many times there is this past time. I think I have already asked you this question. What does this woman mean to you?
Omen?
Which is the voice that came. Who is that speaking? Is it Krishna or demigod?
Demigods.
If it is demigods, that Kamsa is so powerful, right? He can understand that. He is not capable of understanding.
He may not be specific. He may not know which particular demigod it is.
No, but how can he trust his enemy's words?
I don't know.
Okay. Apart from that, he has taken those words very seriously. Until that point of time, he was loving his sister. Now he is because of the demigod, they don't want it to happen. Don't you think from the part of demigod, is that a sin or something, you know, trying to change the heart of a person?
No, because there's reasons why they're doing it. We have to understand the reasons why. So, what the Bhagavatam is teaching us here is divine consciousness and demoniac consciousness. This is Sura and Asura. We have to understand both. So, from the outset of the 10th canto, you're seeing what we should be and what we should not be. So, what's the worst possible thing that you could do? The worst possible thing you could do is grab your sister's hair, you know, minutes after she's been married, and grab a sword and threaten to cut her head off. So can you think of anything which is more demoniac than this? This is about as bad as it gets in the material world. I mean, who would do that? You know, who would grab a sword and grab your sister and be ready to, on a wedding, the day after a wedding? Like, it doesn't... Who does that? The only person to do that is someone who is so self-absorbed, right? And that's where we get the word like demoniac. Prabhupada would use this word, demon. It's like Old English. If you say these days demons, people think it's like it's a strange way of speaking. We don't, you know, people don't speak like, you don't hear people saying, oh, demons. It's like a very old term, but Prabhupada would use this word, demoniac. But it describes perfectly the consciousness of someone who's completely self-absorbed. So he was into his sister, he was loving her, apparently, you know, because people are too self-absorbed, they're in the consciousness of aham mameti, I and mine. So Kamsa was, I am the enjoyer, and this is my sister. So it's completely material consciousness. So as soon as something changed, then immediately he was ready to kill her. So this is demoniac consciousness. Now, if we study the next few verses, how do Vasudeva and Devaki, how do they respond? Right? They're completely equipoised. I mean, as equipoised as you can be in this situation. This is not an easy situation. You know, you just got married. The day after the marriage, and your brother turns up and he's got a sword and he's about to kill your wife. And you have to stay completely equipoised. I mean, these are amazing personalities.
So we're hearing about divine consciousness and demoniac consciousness. Now, why do the demigods want to speed the whole thing up? Because the six sons of Marici, they were cursed to take birth. They will come as the six sons of Devaki, the first six. This is known to the demigods. So they're speeding things up a little bit. They're saying the eighth child will kill you. They want to get, you know, these things happening. From a higher platform, they understand what's taking place here. They understand that Krishna is about to appear, and they also want Yogamaya or Durga to appear, and Balaram as well. So understanding these points, they're beginning to interfere. Now, it is described specifically, it's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam, or it is mentioned, but it doesn't go into the details, but Narada, he gets even further involved. Right? He comes to Kamsa afterwards, and Kamsa, he's just hearing now, there's a voice coming from the sky, and the voice is saying, the eighth child's going to kill you. So in the next couple of days, Narada comes to the palace and comes off as respect to him. He says, please, sit in my palace. So he sits there and Narada discusses with him. And he said, but how do you know which one's number eight? Because if you go backwards, the first one's number eight. And if you start a different way, then the third one is not. So he completely confuses Kamsa. And that's why Kamsa starts killing all the children. He wouldn't have killed the children, but now he's confused which one is number eight. So Narada is... instant, because Narada understands the Lord has a purpose. So Narada is interfering also in order to assist the Lord's pastimes. That's why in India they say, don't be a Narada Muni. Because Narada always causes some problems. I was reading the other day that Lalita was with Krishna, and then Radharani was separate from Lalita and Krishna at that point in time. So then Krishna said to Radharani, he said, be very careful, because Narada, he causes problems with people, and he might even cause problems between you and I. And Radharani said, no, it's not possible, don't worry. Right? But then Narada, he came and he said, he goes to Krishna and he says to Krishna, Krishna with Lalita, he said, I want to see you swinging together on the swing. Madhav, you have to be a little bit more quiet. So he says, I want to see you and you and Lalita swinging on the swing. So Krishna says, no problem. So he gets on the swing with Lalita. But then Narada goes straight to Radharani. And he says, you're not there now, Lalita's on the swing with Krishna. So then she comes very angry. Right? And she gets there. And she says, what's that? And then Krishna knows it. So he just, it's actually for the Lord's pleasure. Because right? He knows that Krishna will get more pleasure from this pastime. And if Radharani gets angry, it's always more pleasure. You know, the husband's like when the wives get a little bit angry. And it just makes everything more interesting. Otherwise, it's boring. So a little bit anger is good. Too much is not good. But a little bit just gives some spice in life. So Krishna, he appreciates. So Narada understands that if Radharani becomes a little angry, then Krishna will enjoy more. You know? So they're helping, they're assisting the pastimes. Any points?
See, you said...
I think your one is true. Yeah, I think that's the way it was.
Okay.
I think that's correct.
And the other thing, it was an embodied voice. But how did they know that the Supreme Personality would be born as a great child and then the king becomes a little king?
The demigods know many things. The guru of the demigods is Narada.
But how did they finish?
Huh?
How did they finish?
How did who know?
Devaki.
How did Devaki know?
Yeah. Because isn't there like...
Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that when Vasudev,
yeah,
Krishna's father, when he was born, there were like very auspicious sounds which came from the sky. And it was said
there was a voice which came from the sky at the time when Vasudev was born, saying that this person, the son of this person, will be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So then he told Devaki when they got married, he said, by the way, our child is going to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Okay.
So she was quite happy.
Okay.
So then when the voice came from the sky, she was actually extremely ecstatic, because when the voice came from the sky, she took this as further indication that my child is going to be the Supreme Lord.
Okay.
So she was feeling very ecstatic.
Okay.
And then Kamsa grabs her by the hair, and it's like she was absorbed in a very deep and exalted state of ecstasy at that time. Any other point?
Yeah.
Which verse are we up to? 35. Kamsa was a condemned personality in the Bhoja dynasty because he was envious and sinful. Therefore, upon hearing this omen from the sky, he caught hold of his sister's hair with his left hand and took up his sword with his right hand to sever her head from her body. Probably.
Kamsa was dragging the chariot and controlling the reins with his left hand. But as soon as he heard the omen that his sister's eighth child would kill him, he gave up the reins, caught hold of his sister's hair, and with his right hand took up a sword to kill her. Before he had been so affectionate that he was acting as his sister's child, but as soon as he heard that his self-interest or his life was at risk, he forgot all affection for her and immediately became a great enemy. This is the nature of demons. No one should trust a demon despite any amount of affection. Aside from this, a king, a politician, or a woman cannot be trusted, since they can do anything abominable for their personal interest. Chanakya Pandit therefore says...
Any points? Yes.
In such scenario, if we don't consider Kamsa as a demon, in such scenario, if someone hears about his prediction that he's going to die for his sister's child, if he's a devotee and not a demon, what his reaction would be?
I don't understand. What's the...
So my point is that Kamsa is a demon.
Yeah.
So if an average person, what we can expect reaction from him in the same scenario. If he hears that, you know, my sister's son is going to kill you, and
everyone's going to act differently. Every single person will act differently. Kamsa is extremely powerful. So in the history of Kamsa is extremely powerful. All the demigods were scared of Kamsa. There was practically no match in the universe for Kamsa. He wasn't just like an ordinary demon. We're talking about someone who's, you know, like I think I said last week, that when Jarasandha attacked Mathura, Kamsa was the king, and he sent the elephant, Kuvalayapede, and we'll hear about him later on, when Krishna goes into Mathura. So he sends Kuvalayapede into the city, and Kuvalayapede is like this elephant, which is as strong as 10,000 elephants, one elephant. So he goes into the city, he would have just destroyed the city, and Kamsa picks up the elephant, throws him back over the wall, and he lands next to Jarasandha. And Jarasandha thinks, okay, then maybe we should go and try to marry some of our daughters to him. There's no use fighting with this guy because he's just throwing the elephant back over the wall. So he goes in and he says, you know, Maharaj, I'll give you my daughters and we'll make an alliance. Jarasandha was also very powerful. So they made it, he gave the daughters and he married and they became. So these are not like ordinary demons. So when Kamsa hears the demigods say, oh, the eighth child will kill you, he thinks, well, who's going to kill me? I'll kill her, and just picks up the sword and is ready to kill her. Does that answer your question? Kind of. Yeah, I mean, the answer is everyone will act differently. Not everyone's going to do the same thing. Kamsa is so powerful. A demoniac person, when a demoniac person becomes strong, they will do practically anything they want, because that's what they think. I mean, what I was thinking about today, because I was meditating on this while I was preparing for the class, if I heard this voice, you know what I would do?
you know, I'd say to Krishna, I'd say, you know, obviously I've done something wrong. You know, if my sister's child's going to kill me, so, you know, please forgive me for whatever I did previously and please help me to become your devotee so I can avoid this whole situation. So, you know, when a conditioned soul gets tested, he has the opportunity. Does he surrender to God or does he defy God? So what does Kamsa do? So I'm not going to surrender to God. And then, so that's what happens to him. He keeps going and then he eventually gets killed by God. Or at that point he could have said, you know, okay, I'm sorry. You know, Krishna will become a devotee. You know, get his japa beat. You know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Hare He could get serious or he could just do that. He could stay defiant. So that's the choice which he's making. Okay, any other points? Okay, so we're hearing here about the bodily concept of life. So as long as you're in the bodily concept of life, then you will absorb yourself in ahamma metti. So this is Kamsa's consciousness. Okay, so then the famous shloka is there. Prabhupada quotes on the lot. Don't trust the woman, the politician, or the king. So what does this mean? We don't trust any woman. This is what it means. You have to understand this point because it's in Prabhupada's book. It says here, don't trust a woman. Prabhupada quotes this a lot. So then we have to know how to answer this question. Otherwise, ISKCON will get into a lot of trouble. ISKCON's already in a lot of trouble. And because Prabhupada says in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that women are less intelligent. So we're already in trouble. It's already difficult enough for us to preach. You know, Prabhupada says all these things in his books. He says women are not intelligent, right? And he says you can't trust them. They're in his books. So it makes it difficult to preach. Because we want people to join our movement. Then you say, oh, here's the Bhagavad Gita. Read the Bhagavad Gita. It's the best book in the world. Okay, women are not very intelligent. Okay, that's good. And then that's it. It's the last time you see that person. So we have to learn how to explain these things so people don't lose their faith in Krishna consciousness. So when it says a woman should not be trusted, this is Rajniti, this is Chanakya speaking to the kings. He's saying don't trust the women means if they come into the court, the prostitutes, they were poisoned from birth. The girls were given a little bit of poison from birth. And each day they were given a little bit of poison. So when they became adults, they had so much poison in their system, they would go and seduce the kings, beautiful girls. And the king would sleep with the girl, and when he would kiss the girl, the poison which was in her body would kill him and then he would die. So they would assassinate the kings in this method. So when it says don't trust a woman, this is what Chanakya is speaking about. I'm not speaking about like any woman. He's saying be very careful. Don't trust a king or a politician. It means be careful of the rival kings, be careful of the women in the court, because they could kill you. Sometimes the women would stab the king, they would seduce the king. And then they would have a dagger or something and kill the king. So that's what Chanakya is saying. He's not saying don't trust any woman. So you have to understand these things. So because otherwise people, they become very confused. In the modern day and age. It's a challenge in our preaching. Otherwise women are not going to join our movement. The lady is the devotee, no problem.
Yeah. And then Srila Prabhupada said also that there was a girl, she used to suffer from typhoid. I'm sure germs of typhoid. But she never used to get sick. But she used to give to others as a carrier. And so other people could get the disease from her. So that's kind of the lady contest.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Okay. Wanting to pacify Kamsa, who was so cruel and envious that he was shamelessly ready to kill his sister, the great soul Vasudeva, who was to be the father of Krishna, spoke to him in the following words. So we're hearing about the opposite. Now we're hearing about Kamsa, the most selfish person. Now we're hearing about Vasudeva, who is the most exalted person, Mahabhagavata. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, no Sanchiti Nakanchiti, one who does not see duality and does not see others in a material way. No? Now, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that Vasudeva is extremely qualified. You have to be extremely qualified to get out of this situation. He pacifies Kamsa. And what Prabhupada says, purity is the force. Now, why is Kamsa even lit? Because Kamsa's enraged at this point in time. He thinks, well, he knows the eighth child's going to kill him. He knows he can kill his sister right now, and he thinks that will somehow alleviate the situation. But for, and he's completely self-absorbed, he's completely powerful, much more powerful than Vasudeva. And yet Vasudeva, by his purity, can stop Kamsa's actions. So it's an amazing, if you meditate on Vasudeva's consciousness and how exalted he must be, that he can actually stop Kamsa at this point, because Kamsa, there's no one who can stop him there. Physically, no one is able to match him, but still he can change his consciousness instantaneously. So this shows his great qualification. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says he's highly qualified, he's extremely clever. No? Devotees are known. Lord Chaitanya, when he teaches Sanatana Goswami, he says devotees have 26 qualities, one of them is daksha. No? So what does daksha mean?
Clever.
Yeah, expert, clever. So devotees are very intelligent. They can get out of things very quickly and easily. You have to be very, and in this material world, you have to be like that. Prabhupada was expert. You read Prabhupada's pastimes. He's very expert at getting through.
Comes from Krishna.
Comes from Krishna. Yeah, ultimately comes from Krishna. Prabhupada went to one meeting, and they're having a meeting. It was in somewhere outside of Mumbai. And it was like a Gita meeting, and they called the gurus from around India, and they were trying to make Bhagavad Gita the main book for India. So they're having a big meeting and everything, and then Prabhupada came in at the end. They'd all been speaking, they're saying Gita should be the book for everyone, it should unite all of India. And Prabhupada walked in, he sat down, they told Prabhupada, this is what we're thinking of doing. And Prabhupada said, it will never work. They're all shocked, like the whole meeting was about making everyone united and peaceful and happy. And Prabhupada said, it will never work because you don't understand the Gita. And they got very upset with Prabhupada. And after Prabhupada chastised them and got on their case, and some of them yelled at Prabhupada and argued with him, and at the end, and then he pacified everyone, expertly. And he says, and then he just made everyone happy, and everyone became completely pacified. And then later on, Prabhupada said, it's only because I'm an old man. He said, because I'm an old man, I can say these things. He said, don't you preach like that. Oh, old man, I can get away with things, but you be very careful how you preach. But Prabhupada was an expert. He upset everyone, rightly so, challenged everyone, told them they were nonsense, and then he made everyone happy again. So he was expert the way he dealt. So we also have to learn to become expert in situations. Because the material world throws things at us all the time. Vasudev said, my dear brother-in-law, Kamsa, you are the pride of your family, the Bhoja dynasty. The great heroes praise your qualities. How could such a qualified person as you kill a woman, your own sister, especially on the occasion of her marriage? So he says, you are the pride of the family. Now the reality was, he was the worst thing that ever happened to the family. He was actually born because his mother was raped by a Gandhava. The Gandhava took the shape of her husband. Right? Was it Gandhava or Rakshasa?
Demon.
He was traveling through the sky and he saw Kamsa's mother in the garden.
Yeah, he came down. I'm just thinking, if it, it wasn't Gandhava. Is there a thing? Is it Rakshasa? Yeah, it'll come up in the commentary soon. But I think he's a Rakshasa, but he's like a shape changer. These demigods can change their form. Demons can also do this. Powerful living entities can change their form. So this demoniac person, he came as Ugrasen, as the Kamsa's father, took that form and came to the mother, right, and seduced her, and then raped her, and then exposed that he was actually this other personality. Kamsa was born from that. And he was the worst thing to happen to the dynasty because he imprisoned his father and he was doing all sorts of, he was very, but now Vasudeva is saying, you are the best thing in our family. You are the best. Why are you acting like this? So he's completely persuading him because he's not the best. He's the worst thing to happen in the family.
the Vasudev needs to speak very quickly and change it.
Isn't it a lie?
Yeah, it is. But the Bhagavatam was already said. Which canon was it? The end of the 8th or the 9th? It wasn't the end of the 9th. Might have been the 8th, I think. It says there are certain circumstances you're allowed to lie. Yeah. So this is a circumstance where lying is okay. Like that. Normally you should not lie, but this is a circumstance where it's okay. O great hero, one who takes birth is sure to die, for death is born with this body. One may die today or after hundreds of years, but death is sure for every living entity. Where is this verse from? Bhagavad Gita. Exactly the same philosophy that Krishna gives in the Gita. So this is the truth. He's just bringing him to his senses. When the present body turns to dust and is again reduced to fire elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, the proprietor of the body, the living being, automatically receives another body of material elements according to his fruitive activities. When the next body is obtained, he gives up the present body. Just as a person traveling on the road rests one foot on the ground and then lifts the other, or as a worm on a vegetable transfers itself to one leaf and then gives up the previous one, the conditioned soul takes shelter of another body and then gives up the one he had before. Having experienced a situation by seeing or hearing about it, one contemplates and speculates about that situation, and thus one surrenders to it. Not considering his present body, similarly, by mental adjustments, one dreams at night of living under different circumstances in different bodies, and forgets his actual position. Under this same process, one gives up his present body and accepts another, tata dehantara prapti. So what is being explained to us here? What is this called? Transmigration of the soul, or other words known as reincarnation. So how did you get the body you have now? By the consciousness that you cultivated in your previous life. And which body will you get next? According to what you're cultivating in this life. So how will you get a spiritual body? Not just think of Krishna, but it's the way you think of Krishna. Yeah. It's what happens to your mind. The whole Bhagavad Gita is about the mind. Krishna says, Mamana Bhavaman Bhakto. Think of me. Now, thinking of Krishna means we have to think of Krishna in a particular relationship with Krishna. That's how you enter into the spiritual world. So you have to think, what is your desire? Do you want to serve Krishna in which particular relationship? And then when you change your consciousness from this body and this mind to a spiritual body and a spiritual mind, then you can enter into Krishna's pastimes. Right? That is the process. It's the process Lord Chaitanya came to teach. It's called Rag Anuga Bhakti. Right? Something we have to cultivate as time goes by. It's not for beginners, but we're in the 10th canto now, so. This is what we're meant to be doing. So according to what you cultivate in your mind, your consciousness, at the time of death, that's what you'll become. So if you cultivate spiritual desires and spiritual thoughts, you can enter Goloka Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada ki. So tonight and I will continue. Just a note on the course. You're meant to be paying your fees every week. And we said this in the first week. So please, I think there's one or two of you doing that. That's the new class rules. So please be obedient and please cooperate. Srila Prabhupada ki.